Obama reproduces the following passage as one that especially struck him. It is this world, a world where cruise ships throw away more food in a day than most residents of Port-au-Prince see in a year, where white folks' greed runs a world in need, apartheid in one hemisphere, apathy in another hemisphere. That's the world. The anti-colonial themes are obvious here, North versus South, rich white Europeans versus the poor, dark-skinned people of Africa and the Caribbean. These were the themes of Obama's life, and he was drawn in from the start. Since Wright's name surfaced during the presidential campaign, there has been much speculation about why Obama picked Trinity as his home church. After all, there were plenty of others to choose from, including several large churches that would also have served as a strong political base for Obama, and others that were closer to the south side of Chicago where Obama lived. Many conservative critics of Obama pointed to Wright's controversial statements, such as his chant of "God damn America," or his insistence that the U.S. government was deliberately spreading AIDS in the black community, and insisted that Obama must have agreed with them. Obama himself said he never heard those statements, and his liberal supporters suggested that perhaps he didn't quite know what Wright was all about. None of this makes any sense. Certainly, it is preposterous to suggest that Obama shared Wright's crackpot conspiracies about AIDS and the government, nor can I envision Obama himself joining with Wright in chanting "Goddamn America." On the other hand, it is equally absurd to claim that Obama was clueless about Wright's real views. He attended the church for 2 decades. Throughout this time, the Obamas supported the church financially, and in 2007 they donated $22,500 to Trinity, their single largest charitable contribution. Wright presided over Obama's wedding and baptized his 2 children. Even more telling, just as Obama took his father's name, Barack, as a tangible sign of his identification with him, so too Obama took the title of Wright's sermon, "The Audacity of Hope," and made it the title of his 2nd book. Some have suggested that Wright became a kind of surrogate father for Obama, and that with his several thousand church members, Wright was perceived by Obama as having succeeded where his own father had failed. If this is the case, then Wright would be Obama's 3rd paternal surrogate, following in the train of Lolo Sotoro and Frank Davis. In any event, over time, Obama and Wright developed a close relationship, and clearly an intelligent man like Obama knew who Wright was and what he stood for. In fact, those were his main reasons for choosing Trinity and staying there. What was it about Wright that appealed so much to Obama? Here we must distinguish between the many faces of Jeremiah Wright. Wright is a character who could easily have appeared in one of Mark Twain's novels, right alongside the Duke and Dauphin. The man is one part civil rights activist, one part Afrocentrist, one part anti-colonialist, and all parts opportunist. He rails against the rich while he himself lives in an affluent, gated community. He met his wife Rama in a rather unusual way. She had been married to someone else, but when she came to him for counseling, he coaxed her into his bed, ultimately convincing her that she would be better off with him than with her husband. Who knows whether Obama was aware of any of this? He certainly did know some of Wright's Afrocentric preoccupations, the white value system and the black value system. Cleopatra was black. Jesus was black. Anyone who invented anything was black, and so on. Most leading anti-colonial thinkers dismiss Afrocentrism as a foolish diversion. "No," admits Aimé Césaire with a hint of impatience, "we've never been Amazons or the kings of Dahomey, nor princes of Ghana with 800 camels. The Nigerian Nobel laureate Wole Soyinka has written sarcastically that Negroes no more need to prove their negritude than tigers need to prove their tigritude. My guess is that, in line with this thinking, Obama dismissed all of Wright's Afrocentric nonsense. He didn't care about it because, in his view, on the really crucial issue, Wright was 100% right. The crucial issue was anti-colonialism, and this is a central theme in Wright's sermons, but it's been ignored because hardly anyone has taken what the man says seriously. Yet Wright has been stressing this theme all along. Asked about his affiliation with black liberation theology on Sean Hannity's show, Wright said there was nothing specifically black about it. Indeed, he claimed to have been influenced by the Sandinistas in Nicaragua and by Asian theologians and Hispanic theologians. Speaking at the National Press Club, Wright showed how his reading of the Bible gave rise to anti-colonialist themes. In Bible history, there's not one word written in the Bible between Genesis and Revelation that was not written under one of six different kinds of oppression: Egyptian oppression, Assyrian oppression, Persian oppression, Greek oppression, Roman oppression, Babylonian oppression. The Roman oppression is the period in which Jesus was born. It sounds like some other governments I know. Here is an extended quotation from The Day of Jerusalem's Fall, a sermon that Wright gave on September 16, 2001, a few days after 9/11. "We took this country by terror away from the Sioux, the Apache, the Iroquois, the Comanche, the Arapaho, the Navajo. Terrorism. We took Africans from their country to build our way of ease and kept them enslaved and living in fear. Terrorism. We bombed Grenada and killed innocent civilians, babies, non-military personnel. We bombed the black civilian community of Panama with stealth bombers and killed unarmed teenagers and toddlers, pregnant mothers and hard-working fathers. We bombed Gaddafi's home and killed his child. Blessed are they who bash your children's heads against the rocks. We bombed Iraq. We killed unarmed civilians trying to make a living. We bombed a plant in Sudan to pay back an attack on our embassy. Killed hundreds of hard-working people, mothers and fathers, who left home to go that day, not knowing they would never get back home. We've bombed Hiroshima. We've bombed Nagasaki. We've nuked far more than the thousands in New York and the Pentagon, and we never batted an eye. Kids playing in the playground, mothers picking up children after school, civilians, not soldiers, people just trying to make it day by day. We have supported state terrorism against the Palestinians and black South Africans, and now we are indignant, because the stuff we have done overseas is now brought back into our own front yard." I have left out the part that was most widely reported in the media: the Reverend Wright's insistence that 9/11 was a case of America's chickens coming home to roost. Forget about that line, which is in any case lifted from Malcolm X. The point is that Wright's remarks are consistent and well thought out. There is an ideology here. Note that Wright does exactly what Obama was training himself to do. He took the slavery issue, but then incorporated it into a larger pattern that included the whole world. He fits the civil rights issue into the larger anti-colonial issue. This is the core of Wright's thinking, and it was entirely in line with Obama's own thinking. And that, I believe, is why Obama felt right at home at Trinity. But now it is time to leave American shores and join Obama on the most important journey of his life. This was his first trip to Kenya, which he took in 1988 when he was 26 years old. Obama's chapter on Kenya takes up 130 pages of Dreams from My Father, and it represents the culmination of his quest for self-identity. As we will see, it was a kind of pilgrimage, complete with its scenes of trial, redemption, temptation, and vindication. Obama emerges from Kenya born again, not in the religious sense, but rather ideologically. From that point on, Obama is already made, or self-made, and the rest of our study will be devoted to seeking an application of Obama's ideology to his presidential run as well as to his domestic and foreign policy. At the time of his death, Obama said of his dad, "My father remained a myth to me, both more and less than a man." Obama's half-sister, Auma, visited him in New York while he attended Columbia. She told him for the first time about how humiliated and degraded their father had become, dropping from one low post to another even lower. Aoma vividly described how Barak Sr. would stagger into her room drunk at night and rage about how he had been betrayed by the world. Obama's reaction shows how hard he took this news. I felt as if my world had been turned on its head, as if I had woken up to find a blue sun in the yellow sky, or heard animals speaking like men. To think that all my life I had been wrestling with nothing more than a ghost. Obama intended his African Odyssey to find out the truth about his father for himself, and it's worth following it in some detail. Like Marlowe in Conrad's Heart of Darkness, Obama pushes deeper and deeper into the heart of Africa, seeking in this case not an ivory empire but a different kind of treasure, a truth to guide his life. On the flight to Nairobi, Obama sits next to a young Englishman who is on his way to South Africa. "The rest of Africa's falling apart now, isn't it?" he informs Obama. "The blacks in South Africa aren't starving to death like they do in some of these godforsaken countries." Obama glares at him while the man drops off to sleep. In this anonymous Englishman, Obama has his first experience of the neo-colonial mentality. At the Nairobi airport, Obama is met by Aoma and his aunt Zaituni, and the aunt makes a strange statement to Aoma. "You take good care of Barry now. Make sure he doesn't get lost again." Aoma explains that lost in this context doesn't just mean that someone hasn't seen you in a while. Rather, it refers to native Africans who have gone abroad and have never been heard from again. They are lost in the sense of being cut off from their own people, their own roots. Later, one of Obama's half-brothers will explain to him that he has not just returned home, he has returned to home squared. For people who go abroad, Roy Obama explains, there's your ancestral home, and there's your true home. Your true home is your ancestral home, which is home twice over, and therefore, home squared. Obama finds this whole concept quite profound. Having lunch with Aoma at the New Stanley Hotel, Obama takes note of the tourists. They were everywhere, Germans, Japanese, British, Americans, taking pictures, hailing taxis, fending off street peddlers, many of them dressed in safari suits like extras on a movie set. In Hawaii, Obama found the tourists amusing, with their sunburns and their pale, skinny legs. Not so in Kenya. Here in Africa, the tourists didn't seem so funny. I felt them as an encroachment somehow. I found their innocence vaguely insulting. It occurred to me that in their utter lack of self-consciousness, they were expressing a freedom that neither Aoma nor I could ever experience. A bedrock confidence in their own parochialism, a confidence reserved for those born into imperial cultures. Notice that Obama, despite his privileged background, despite Columbia and Harvard, identifies not with the American tourists but with the native people of Africa, and he lumps American tourists into those born into imperial cultures. An American family sits down to eat, and the waiters spring into action. Since Aoma and he were there first, Obama is outraged at being passed over for service. The waiters ignore his beckoning gestures. Indignant, Aoma and Obama leave, and Aoma comments that even in Africa, African women are treated like prostitutes. The same in any of these big office buildings. If you don't work there and you are African, they will stop you until you tell them your business. But if you're with a German friend, they are all smiles. "Good evening, miss," they'll say. Kenya, Aoma concludes, is the whore of Africa, Barak. It opens its legs to anyone who can pay. Obama reflects bitterly that not all the tourists in Nairobi had come for the wildlife. Some came because Kenya, without shame, offered to recreate an age when the lives of whites in foreign lands rested comfortably on the backs of the darker races. And he's not finished. Did our waiter know that black rule had come? Did it mean anything to him? Through an act of reflection, Obama converts his poor treatment at a restaurant into a case study in the workings of neocolonialism. If all of this seems like multicultural mind games, we have to realize that Obama does not see it that way at all. To him, these episodes are all part of a grand drama. At one point, Obama finds himself turning onto Kimathi Street. He knows the name. Kimathi was one of the leaders of the Mau Mau Rebellion. Of course, Obama has read his history. He tells us he read a book about Kimathi back in Chicago and can still remember the man's dreadlocks. And now he can feel only anger because no one else seems to know who Kimathi is.